Spiros Aimer yesterday, and I think I had asked two questions, only one of which was answered, and that is the first question was that the Torah says that the Aimer is counted mimacharas ha-Shabbos, the day after Shabbos, but the interpretation of that is the day after Pesach. The Tzdukim, however, contended that it meant Sunday, and the question is, why did the Torah use the ambiguous term Shabbos instead of the more clear term mimacharas ha-Pesach? So the answer that we said yesterday from the Meshech Chachma, just to review it very quickly, is that Shabbos and Pesach have a common denominator, in that Shabbos is a gift that was given to us through nothing we did on our part. The idea of Shabbos predated the creation of a Jewish people, and therefore it represents a matana which was not deserved. It was simply given to us out of Hashem's love, and that is similar to the redemption of Pesach, where the Jewish people were not worthy of redemption in their own right. They were in the 49th level of Tumah. They were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a matana, a matnas chinam of Geula. And that matnas chinam of Geula is the common denominator between Pesach and Shabbos, conferring a Shabbos-like quality on the Geula of Pesach. And the Meshech Chachma quotes a medrash that indicates that we find that on Pesach, Klal Yisrael is referred to as the child of God, the Bas, Biti. And on Shavuos, it is called Achosi, brother, sister. Actually, there's a lot of mixed imagery here, because Shavuos is also the imagery of a wedding. So on one hand, it's almost an incestuous combination there, because we are called the sister of God, we are called the bride. But of course, even in Shir HaShirim, you have such a mixed lashon, where Hashem, or the king, who is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, refers to the woman, who is Klal Yisrael, Achosi Kala, my sister, my bride. Obviously, it's understood in that case, that's just Achosi is simply a particular term of endearment and closeness. But the Meshech Chacham points out, the difference between sister and wife on one hand, and child on the other, is the child, particularly a newborn infant, simply receives from the parents and is not in a position to really give anything back. When you have wife, sister, there is reciprocity of relationship. So in this idea, the idea of Sfiras HaOmer is God shows us on Pesach the ideal self. God lifts us up and shows us what we can become. And Sfiras HaOmer, we go through the laborious process of trying to become what we know we're able to become. That's why people say, back. It's a very funny thing. Just the past few days, I've been talking to different people. People call up from the States sometimes with Shilas. And it's very interesting that I hear over and over, I was thinking of this word, and I hear over and over again, people are saying, you know, people who are going through marital problems, they're saying, you know, Pesach was wonderful, but as soon as Pesach is over, you know, things are falling apart again. So it's an interesting thing. It ties into the idea that Pesach, Hashem shows us what we could have, what we're capable of doing, but Shavuos is the idea of earning. And again, just to review the point again, that's why they say Pesach has Seder. Seder is God gives you precise and explicit direction. Shavuos is Shtei HaLechem, two loaves of bread were brought as a korban, and Lechem is reminiscent of the verse in Bereishis, by the sweat of your brow, Peseyas HaBecha Tocha Lechem, and that connotes the idea of work and Yegia. Now the truth of the matter is, what Hashem treasures above all is the amount of effort we put in and struggle in Avodas Hashem. The Mabit even says an amazing thought. The Mabit was one of the Mabit is Moshe ben Yosef Trani. Mabit is, he lived in Tzfat. He was a contemporary of the Beis Yosef, or slightly earlier than the Beis Yosef, in the 1500s, and was one of the very first Achronim, kind of on the border between the Mishonim and Achronim. And the Mabit interprets a Gemara in Kesuvos, a very interesting Gemara in Kesuvos. The Gemara in Kesuvos talks about Rav Yoshua ben Levi, that Rav Yoshua ben Levi was once had a what is now called a near-death experience. He was clinically dead, and he was revived. And apparently, while he was clinically dead, his neshama went to Olam Haba. And when he was revived, he was asked, "What did you see in Olam Haba?" And his response was, "Olam hafuch ra'isi, I saw a topsy-turvy world. I saw an opposite world from this world. Elyonim, the big shots in this world, Lamata, are pretty low in that world. And the Tachtonim, and the people who are inferior in this world, are Elyonim, are very high in that world. This is what the world is topsy-turvy. Now the question that Mabit raises is, what do we mean by Elyonim in this world and Tachtonim? If he means Elyonim means rich, powerful people, there's no chiddush. In other words, of course, just because, I don't mean to say a rich person can't be a tzaddik, but just because you're rich, powerful, and politically well-connected, that obviously is not going to count in Olam Haba. In other words, what is the chiddush? What is the innovation in his statement that the big shots in this world are not going to be big shots in that world? So the Mabit says a very big chiddush. The Mabit says, you know what a big shot means? It's a big shot. Elyonim means? It means somebody that's Elyonim in ruchnius, in spiritual matters. What does that mean? Let's compare two people. One person is a real, real genius, right? So he could learn 100 pages of Gemara a day. He could learn 100 pages of Gemara a day. And he can even do that in 5 hours. So he has the rest of the day to watch movies or, go to the beach, whatever it is. So he learns 100 glot of Gemara a day and he knows it by heart, Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos. And another person is not so gifted, and the person struggles along, and he puts all of his energies and all of his kochos, and maybe he could do one Mishnah a day. Now most people, from externally, we look at a guy who knows 100 glot of Gemara a day, Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, and we say, that person is a real Talmud Chacham, etc. And his spiritual accomplishments, we might think, are greater. But Rav Yeshua ben Levi says, that's not the way God measures it. God does not measure what you accomplish in the tangible sense. God measures how much of yourself have you given to him. The person who gives 100%, even if that doesn't produce very much in an external sense, is more beloved to God than the person who produces a tremendous amount but only works at 25% of his capacity. Right? Hashem judges us by how much we give. It's the efforts. It's not the silver platter, which means to say, basically, those who are, as you would expect, those who are more gifted are by definition expected to do more. In other words, this is a big Yetzirah that a person might have, because, in fact, any religious Jew can have this Yetzirah, because you look around at the world and you say, well, listen, I do more mitzvos than 90% of Klal Yisrael. So what? I don't daven shachris with kavana. I daven shachris. Most Jews don't daven shachris. Most Jews don't put on tefillin. Most Jews don't keep Shabbos. Most Jews don't keep kashrus. I'm way ahead of the game. But the problem is, we're not defining the game correctly. The game is not a competitive sport against other people. The game is, how much of ourselves are we giving to Hashem? And that's why we don't really know how Hashem judges, that the Rambam says nechus tshuva. We have no idea, but it could very well be. I remember when I used to work for NCSY. NCSY is like a youth group in the States, an Orthodox youth group, which many of whom, I don't know if most, but many of whose kids do not come from religious homes. And kids used to tell amazing stories. It's hard to even know why parents would be this way, about how bitterly opposed their parents were to their keeping Shabbos. That when it came Shabbos, they'd have to light candles in their room away from their parents, or lock themselves in their bathroom in their house. And again, halachically there are questions about that. You can't make a bracha about that, but whatever it is, but they would light Shabbos candles in the bathroom. And a girl would describe how she would, be alone in her bedroom making kiddush over two challahs while her parents would be watching the dating game on television in the living room, etc. Now, let's imagine that such a person obviously maybe did not keep Shabbos in a fullest extent. Maybe, all the halachas weren't known, etc. And then you take another person who lives in a totally religious environment and keeps Shabbos 100% because that's the way they were brought up. In an objective level, we would say, well, the Shabbos that's kept 100% is better than the Shabbos that's kept, 70% or 60%. But the truth is, in Hashem's judgment, where Hashem judges us based on our struggle and our sacrifice. As Pirkei Avos says, Lefum Tzara Agra. It could very well be that the person who struggles to keep Shabbos at 50% might be a greater accomplishment than the person who slides through and keeps Shabbos at 100%. Now, the question you might ask is, so isn't that reverse discrimination? In other words, can't the chassid or the Borough Park person come to God legitimately and say, hey, it's not fair. Just because I was born in a religious family and in a religious environment, and I don't have to struggle to keep kosher and keep Shabbos, I get a raw deal. I don't get as much reward. What do you want from me? The answer is, everybody has something that they have to struggle with. See, the mistake is, in other words, the person who's born into a religious family, who is surrounded by Shabbos observers, may not have to struggle with the issue of whether to keep Shabbos or not to keep Shabbos. That may not be the struggle. And Ein Hachinami, he's not going to get reward for that struggle. So the struggle will be on a different level, not to speak Lashon Hara. The struggle might be to have more Kavanah during davening. In other words, this is a point that Rav Dester makes. Rav Dester makes a point that every person has what is called a Nekudas HaBechira. Nekudas HaBechira literally means a point of choice, the fulcrum at which you could go either way. Meaning to say, some people are going to get tremendous reward because they walked by a McDonald's and didn't go in. Because for some people, that's their trial. There are other people who are not going to get rewarded. A Mea Shearim person is not going to get rewarded for walking by McDonald's, not going in, because that's not an issue. But that doesn't mean there aren't struggles that they have to go through. In other words, the point is, there is enough struggle in life that everybody has a struggle for which God will reward you. But the point is, and therefore it's not, the accusation of unfair discrimination is not true, because everyone has that struggle, because in Avodas Hashem there are infinite levels. Even if you keep all the mitzvos, there's always a new level of internalization, of kavana, of depth, of growth, right? When you've learned Bavli, you have to learn Yerushalmi, but it's not just quantity in terms of understanding, etc. But that's the point. The point is, God rewards us because of our struggle. Pesach is gift. Svira and Shavuos is work and struggle. And ultimately, that is what matters. I'm sorry, do you want to say something?
Question.
Yeah.
When you say the reverse person who says, well, I didn't grow up religious, so therefore whatever I keep is good enough?
Well, the answer is this. Listen, again, I mean, I can't speak directly for God, because God has his standards. But it is undoubtedly the case.
How do you motivate
someone? The answer is that God may not hold a person accountable for what they don't know. But once you know the truth, you do have to act upon it. You see what I'm saying? In other words, there may be a preliminary issue. Does the person believe there's a God? Does the person believe Torah is from heaven? You know, those are preliminary issues. But once you know that's the truth, then how can you deny it? That's like saying, you know, people say this, and it makes no sense at all. Well, actually, it makes a little bit of sense. But people might say, people have a pain. And they don't know, you know, God forbid it might be cancer, it might be a heart attack. And they say, I don't want to go to a doctor because he may tell me it's something bad. Now, the point is, you know, it's there. You can't ignore what you know is there. And truth is that way as well. You know, the truth doesn't go away by simply making believe it's not there. So, in a way, I knew a guy in Silver Spring. This was the craziest thing. This was a person, a brilliant person. He was a PhD in physics, and he came from an Orthodox family, and you know, his mother was an old woman, a concentration camp survivor, who called me up from New York and said, please talk to my son, because he's not religious anymore, and you know, see what you can do to him. So we talked, and you know what his position was? The most amazing thing in the world. I mean, he's a brilliant man. He said that he knows he's a sinner, he knows he's moved away from God, but he doesn't want to start doing mitzvos, because then God is going to notice him. And if God notices him, God's going to punish him for everything he did for those years. He says, this way, he figures God doesn't notice. he said God doesn't notice because he's not really doing anything for God, so God kind of put him out of sight, out of mind. I thought the guy was joking, but I talked to him for a long time, and this was his philosophy of life at this point. He said he'd rather not start tshuva. But that's the same attitude that said, I'm not going to check out this tumor because it may be cancerous, so I'll just let it go. But if it's true, you've got to deal with it. But the point I want to make is that which is done with struggle, this should permeate all of our attitudes, let's assume, in the classroom. In the classroom, we always give the best rewards to people who get the highest grades. But in terms of the spiritual accomplishment, it's the people who put in the most effort that are the most worthy. Now, we give lip service to that. It's true. Teachers say that, parents say that. But that's not really what we reward in this world. But in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's cheshbon, it is the effort that is most important.
Isn't there like two levels though? Like you get rewarded for one, the effort, and two, the mitzvah. In other words,
right.
Like a guy who observes Shabbat, the Pum guy, he still gets rewarded for Shabbat.
The other person
gets rewarded for Shabbat and the effort.
Yes. I didn't mean to say that there's no reward for a mitzvah, even if it's easy. Obviously, there's a tremendous reward for a mitzvah. But Pirkei Avos indicates that the bulk of the schar is on the effort part. The effort part is more than the mitzvah part.
Okay.
Now, this is even true by a Shalom Zah. Yeah.
So wouldn't this stay away from punishment?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Are intrinsically wrong.
The Gemara says in Maseches Menachos, Kasha onshan shel lavan yaisu mishal techeles. Now what does that mean? On tzitzis, actually now it's coming back into vogue a little bit, but the Torah requires that on tzitzis, in addition to the white strings, you have a blue string or two blue strings which are dyed with a dye of a special sea creature. It's a mollusk or a type of shellfish. For hundreds of years, we did not really know the identity of this chilazon. In recent years, there are those who have claimed to identify it, and that's why you can now get techeles. Many gedolim have not endorsed it, so it's kind of an open question at this point. But be it as it may, techeles was very expensive. So it says if a guy doesn't bother to get tzitzis because he doesn't want to spend money, so it says in Chazal he will be more punished for not buying the regular tzitzis than he will be for not buying the techeles. Why? Because since not buying the techeles costs more money, so the pshat is like this: in Aveira, which is where there's more of a Yetzer Hara to do, there's a certain element of reduction of punishment. See, in other words, the Aveira of Techeles is more understandable because it costs more money. In other words, God will punish me more for the Aveira that I was unwilling to spend $5 than for an Aveira that I was unwilling to spend $100. It's kind of that comparative idea. I just want to connect it to the minhag of a Shalom Zachar. I don't know if you had a Shalom Zachar yourself or you remember a Shalom Zachar, but Shalom Zachar is a minhag Yisrael that the Shabbos it's the Shabbos before a bris. The bris is delayed, you actually delay the Shalom Zachar, but it's either the Shabbos after a boy is born or the Shabbos before a bris. We make a big party for the child and we welcome him home. Shalom Zachar, welcome to the boy. And it's brought down that one of the things you serve at a Shalom Zachar is chickpeas, arbis, right? The time-honored thing. And what's the reason for arbis? Arbis is a circular or oval type food, like an egg. And we know that that's associated with comforting a mourner. Because, you give a mourner an egg or chickpeas, although we typically give an egg, but chickpeas is also acceptable, because it reminds a person that life is a changing cycle. That there are bad times in life, but then there'll be good times as well. So why are you serving mourning food, M-O-U-R-N, at a Shalom Zachar? So states, because you have to comfort the baby. The baby is in a state of sadness being born into this world. Because before the baby was born, Chazal say, an angel taught the baby in the womb of the mother all of the Torah. When the baby was born, the malach smite smote the baby on the lip, that's the indentation you have over your lip here. That's where the angel hits you. So if you don't have one, I mean, you probably know a lot of Torah. So they do say that. They do say, I mean, there are stories about kids that are born without it. As soon as they're born, they know, you know, they start reciting Gemaras and things. But yeah. I don't know if they've been verified, because the stories usually end with the baby dying very soon afterwards. Like, you know, it was a mistake on the production line. Gotta, you know, take him back. But the concept is, the baby apparently has an awareness of what it lost. The neshama feels that. And therefore there's tremendous sadness coming into the world without the Torah. So we are menachem the avel. We comfort the baby by serving the chickpeas. This is, as we recorded.
For a woman too.
An interesting question. It's a very interesting question, because women have this too, and presumably women at least are taught the Torah that they need to know. In fact, even non-Jews have this. And we have to assume it's the seven commandments of Noach that they were taught. It's a good question. But I guess since the chiyuv, the obligation of studying Torah, is on men, so the loss is a more painful loss. Which is why I suggested the halacha that it's important to have the Shalom Zachor where the baby is. See, this is interesting, because sometimes mother and baby might still be in a hospital or somewhere else. And often they make a Shalom Zachor. You know, the husband may go home for the other kids or whatever it is. They make a Shalom Zachor where the husband is. But according to this idea, it's important to make the Shalom Zachor where the baby is. The baby is the one that you're actually comforting. Now, the question you might think about is the following. What is the purpose of a baby learning the whole Torah before it's born if it's going to forget it anyway? Like, why bother? What is the purpose of... Now, this is based, by the way, on a verse in Eev. Eev says, when Eev is complaining about his life, Eev talks about the good old days. I really miss the good old days. So Chazal say, the good old days do not refer to his life on this earth before his tragedies. It refers to the days of the womb. Mi yibnei mi ki yarche keda. Yarche literally means the months of pregnancy. So question number one is, what's the purpose of teaching the angel teaching the kid Torah if he's going to take it away anyway? And number two, why does he take it away? But the answer is this. You know, they say, I guess it is true, although I haven't tried riding a bike recently, that you never forget how to ride a bicycle, right? Certain things you learn, and even if you haven't done it for many, many years, you never really forget it. And generally speaking, once you've learned something, even if you think you've totally forgotten it, relearning will always have a shock of recognition. It sounds familiar. God wanted Torah to be imprinted onto the soul of a Jew. That a Jewish soul that comes to Torah is never really coming to something foreign, something strange, something new. It's something that somehow you've heard before. You've been exposed to it, not only at Matan Torah per se, but even in your own individual life. That God wanted Torah to be natural to us. God wanted Torah to be the language that our souls instinctively respond to. And therefore the process of learning it before, even if we forget the information. In fact, what is the definition of culture? There's a nice definition of culture. What is a cultured person? Culture is what remains when everything else that was learned is forgotten. You may forget the information, but the culture of Torah, the holy Torah is in the neshama. Now, the question is though, why does God make us forget it? And the answer is, because the stuff that we get on a silver platter isn't really an accomplishment. The accomplishment of life is to struggle and gain it on our own. And that is really how we comfort the baby. We comfort the baby by effectively telling him, baby, all that wonderful Torah that you got was great, but that's not the purpose of existence. The purpose of existence is not simply to have things handed to you. The purpose of existence is for you to struggle and come to them on your own. And that's why it says the Vilna Gaon, who of course mastered the entire Torah, angels would come to him and they would beg him to allow them to teach him secrets of the Torah. They would say, we want to show you this, we want to show you this. And he turned them down. Because he says, I want my Torah to come through yigiyah, through efforts, and through work, and through sacrifice. I don't want things to come to me. In fact, they have all sorts of stories about the Vilna Gaon. They say in dealing with the Vilna Gaon that, you know, the Vilna Gaon had a shita that until you recite the blessings over the Torah in the morning, you're not even allowed to think of Torah. We don't paskin that way. We paskin you could think of Torah, but you're not allowed to say words of Torah. So I think one time before Birchas HaTorah, the Vilna Gaon, as soon as he woke up, he thought of 20 explanations for a pasuk. No, 20 explanations. And he was so upset because, you know, you're not supposed to think about this. So he prayed all day so Hashem would make him forget it. And, you know, for the Vilna Gaon to forget something is a pretty big miracle. You know, it's it reminds me of when AT&T was making a commercial. I'm trying to remember, this is about Bill Russell, basketball player. So it was one of those things where he was supposed to shoot a basket, he was supposed to shoot a ball at a basket. He was supposed to miss and say something like, "You never miss with AT&T." And they had a tremendous problem because Bill Russell could not miss a basket. In other words, he got every basket. So they had to reshoot it like 50 times till he was able to miss. You know, so to pray to forget Torah with Vilna Gaon is like much bigger miracle than Bill Russell missing a basket. Okay, but that's the idea of Yigiyah. That's the idea of Shavuos and Lefum Tzara Agra. I should also just mention one other thing in this regard. You know, the Rambam says that every person can be as great a tzaddik as Moshe Rabbeinu and as great a rasha as Yeravam ben Nevat. If you recall the book of Malachim, Yeravam ben Nevat was the first breakaway king of the 10 tribes. Right, he broke away the Malchus from Shlomo's son, Rechavam. Yeravam ben Nevat was a big egotist. The Gemara says he was actually a great tzaddik at one point in his life. And God came to Yeravam ben Nevat, this is an amazing thing, and he said to Yeravam ben Nevat, "Yeravam, do tshuva. And you, and David HaMelech, and I, Hashem, will walk together in Gan Eden." So Yeravam ben Nevat asked one question, who's going to be first in line? And Hashem said, well, David will be first. Yeravam says, I'm not taking the deal. Actually, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, when Yeravam was asking who's going to be first, he wasn't only asking, is it David or me? He was saying, no, he was actually counting on God. He said, oh God, you're going to be first. I don't want to deal with that. That's how blinded. But anyway, but the Rambam does say, these are the extremes. Because of free will, we can be like Moshe, or we can be like Yeravam. So the question is very obvious. How is it shaykh to say, how is it possible to say that any of us could be like Moshe Rabbeinu? The Torah says, there is no prophet as great as Moshe. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman says a very nice explanation. If you look, and it ties into what we're talking about now, the idea of struggle and giving of yourself to Hashem. If you look at the book of Yehoshua, when it talks about Moshe dying, it uses the phrase, Moshe is Eved Hashem. Vayamas Moshe, Moshe died Eved Hashem. Why is Moshe called the slave of God? So the Radak, one of the great Mefarshim, says, this is designed to pick up a halacha. There's a halacha about a slave. Ma shekana eved. Whatever a slave owns or acquires, kana rabo, belongs to his master. Eved Hashem is that quality, that whatever you are, you give over to God. That's the Radak. So Rav Elchanan says, with this Radak, we can understand the Rambam. When the Rambam says, every person can be a Moshe Rabbeinu, that means every person can be an Eved Hashem. Meaning, we're not as smart as Moshe Rabbeinu, we're not as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, we don't have any of the natural abilities he had. But just as whatever he was, he gave to Hashem. Whatever we are, even if it's many, many times lower, we can also give to Hashem. And in that way, we become the Eved Hashem that Moshe Rabbeinu is. That's what the Rambam means, that each person can give his totality to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And to the extent of that totality, one is an Eved Hashem. And an Eved Hashem is really the greatest thing that one could be. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim to be His Avadim. Right? Ki Avadayim. He took us out from one servitude to be the servitude of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that is the idea of, that's just completing the idea of Pesach is the gift that God gives us. Shavuos is the reciprocity of our Kabbalah Satira. Now the second question, which I didn't get to, let me just answer that relatively briefly, and that is, why is it so that we count the Omer the second day of Pesach? Right? We don't start the first day. The Torah says, Mimach. Counting Sefira the second day of Yom, but insofar as the Torah is concerned, it's Chol HaMoed. In Eretz Israel, Sefira HaOmer is Chol HaMoed. You don't do it on Yom Tov proper. So the Sefer HaChinuch says like this. Sefer HaChinuch says that the Gemara has a klal called Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. What is Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha? We don't mix joys together. We don't make a wedding on Yom Tov. Why? Because the joy of a wedding detracts a little bit from the joy of a Yom Tov. Why? Because when your mind is on the joy of the wedding, you're not thinking about the joy of the Yom Tov. Or conversely, if you're thinking about the joy of the Yom Tov, you're not thinking about the joy of the wedding. This is actually might be counterintuitive. We might have thought better to accumulate joyous occasions. But the Gemara actually says, Ein Marvin Simcha B'Simcha. We don't want to mix simchas because that prevents the 100% concentration on each simcha separately. So the Sefer HaChinuch argues that since the first day of Pesach is a Yom Tov, which commemorates Yitzias Mitzrayim, and Sviras HaOmer is already the count, well, it's not countdown, it's count up to Shavuos, which is the next holiday, you don't want to dilute the significance of Yitzias Mitzrayim by already talking about Shavuos, and therefore we defer Sviras HaOmer until next day. This is what Sefer HaChinuch says. The truth of the matter is, however, the Sefer HaChinuch's reason is a bit problematical for two reasons, really. Number one, if you're going to apply Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha to why we don't count Sefira on the first day of Pesach, then logically we shouldn't count it at all, even during Chol HaMoed, because Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha applies even to Chol HaMoed. You don't make a wedding even on Chol HaMoed, because the wedding takes away from the joy of the Yom Tov, right? So if you literally took that thought to its logical extension, the halacha would be you would defer Sefira totally. But the second reason, yeah.
So if you're not allowed to mix simchas and right. Chol HaMoed, do that, why are we allowed to turn Sefira HaOmer, a time which would be a joyful time, basically a mourning time?
Yeah, I'll come to that. That's a very excellent point. But for now, the only thing that you, I guess you are aware of it, but let me just be sure that everyone now understands this, that originally Sefiras HaOmer was a joyous time, and it was only much, much later in Talmudic and post-Talmudic times that it was converted to a mourning period because of the deaths of Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim, meaning integrally it is supposed to be a joyous time. Well, I will discuss by what process could it become converted into a time of sadness, but that's a very excellent point. But the other thing is the following. The other reason why the Chinuch's reason is a little difficult is for what the Chinuch himself explains. The Chinuch explains that the whole purpose of Sefiras HaOmer, countdown or count up, is to link Pesach and Shavuos. Right? We mentioned this yesterday. Pesach is the holiday of freedom. Shavuos is the holiday of submission and commitment. Sefira is a linkage between those two zmanim to teach us that the meaning of freedom is when there is submission to the will of Hashem. And that's why Chazal say the korban of Pesach is barley, which is animal fodder, and the korban of Shavuos is wheat, which is human food, because freedom without commitment to Hashem is just like a wild animal. Okay, that's a very important lesson. Certainly when you look in the United States, or Western culture generally, where freedom is glorified as the highest goal. But the question then becomes, freedom to be what? And the answer is, there's no answer to that. In other words, we have millions of kids who are free, but they're not free to be anything, because there is no particular image of what they should be with that freedom. And as I mentioned, I think I mentioned it, but this is one of the reasons why the teenage suicide rate is very high in affluent countries. Because when kids have what they want satisfied, but they don't have a sense of meaning and purpose, there is a pain in their hearts, which may result in the extreme measure of even taking one's life in desperation. Because human beings are godly, our souls are godly, and a godly soul seeks to be connected with God. And when it doesn't have the wherewithal, or the knowledge, or the skill, or the structure to be able to do that, that soul is dying of starvation. Okay, we can't imagine. But again, I would refer you to Viktor Frankl's works. Frankl was not even a religious Jew at all. Well, actually, I should qualify that. I think he was a very religious Jew, in the sense of having a very strong sense of godliness. But he was not an observant Jew. He did not keep mitzvahs. But out of his experiences in the concentration camps, he pointed out how vital a sense of meaning in life is. That he considered that to be more vital than even biological needs. So, in a sense, Shavuos is not a separate holiday. Shavuos is what gives Pesach its meaning, which is why in rabbinic literature, the holiday of Shavuos is called Atzeres. Not Shmini Atzer. Shavuos is called Atzeres. Atzeres literally means the conclusion. Shavuos is part two of Pesach. In fact, although we don't give you a Ben Hazmanim from Pesach to Shavuos, but you could look at Sfiras HaOmer as one long Chol HaMoed that is bracketed by a Yom Tov of Pesach and a Yom Tov of Shavuos. Right? You can look at it as a Chol HaMoed in that sense. Of course, a Chol HaMoed that allows you to eat chametz once you're past the first 7 days. So in that sense, I think, doesn't this bring us back to square one? Meaning to say, the Sefer HaChinuch says we don't count Omer till the second day of Pesach because we don't want to detract from the happiness of Yitzias Mitzrayim. That's his answer, Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. But I'm suggesting that at least a potential problem with that answer is that if in fact Omer is designed to link Pesach and Shavuos by telling us that the meaning of freedom is its submission to Hashem, then perhaps it should stand to reason that we ought to go back to the first day. But as I'll give you another answer shortly, but I just want to say that I was thinking, you know, one of the things that Ashkenazim do, Sfardim don't necessarily do this, but Ashkenazim, after you finally wash at the Seder, and you eat the matzah, and you don't cover yourself or anything, and of course you have to save your appetite for the afikoman, very important, but the first course that is often served among Ashkenazim is a hard-boiled egg. A hard-boiled egg is eaten at the Seder itself. And that also is connected to mourning. We are comforting the mourners. But what is the Knicham Avelim? Because the first night of Pesach is the same night as Tisha B'Av later in the summer. Pesach falls out the same night of the week, or day of the week, as Tisha B'Av. So if this year the first Seder was, Wednesday? Yeah, Wednesday night, Thursday. Tisha B'Av this summer will be Wednesday night, Thursday. Now, why does the calendar work out that way? So perhaps we might suggest, this is homiletical thought, but I think it's a valid thought, like this. The first night of Pesach is the only night of Pesach that is not yet connected to Shavuos, because you don't start counting the Omer until night two. Therefore, the first night represents pure freedom that has not yet been encumbered by submission to God's Torah. So maybe the teaching here is a Pesach that is not connected to a Shavuos will lead to a Chorban, will lead to a destruction and a Golus. Meaning, freedom without constraints and without limits ultimately leads to destruction of society. That might be the particular remez there. You'll ask me, so why do people have a hard-boiled egg at the second Seder? But that's not a kasha, because the only reason we have the second Seder is because it might be the first night. You're counting the Omer because it's the second night, so that's not a problem. Okay. But still, so why is it the day after, though? So actually, I'll give you an answer to Zohar. The Zohar gives an answer, an interesting answer. I'll pick Kabbalah. The Zohar says like this. If we perceive of Shavuos as a wedding between God and the Jewish people, Yom Chasunasa, it is a wedding, then in effect, Klal Yisrael needs to prepare for the wedding like a woman before marriage. Now, if you know the laws of family purity, a woman before marriage, because she's a status of a nida, a woman that has menstruated, she needs to have 7 clean days, 7 days without contamination of the blood before she can go to the mikveh and be with her husband. So the Sfiras HaOmer, it is said, although it's a week per day, so it's not clear, but these 7 weeks represent the 7 clean days, the 7 days of separation from Egypt, which allows us for communion. Now, the first day, however, cannot count as one of those days, 7 clean days, because in Egypt, because the night of the 15th is still in Egypt. We didn't leave until the morning. Therefore, that's like the Hefsek Tara. In other words, when a woman is bleeding, the day she stops bleeding, she examines herself to be sure that she's clean. But the 7 clean days don't start until after, the next day, because you have to have 24 hours. So the first day, says the Zohar, is the day of Hefsek. It is the day of severance from the Tumah of Mitzrayim, but the 7 clean days don't start until the day after. That's what the Zohar says, that you cannot count the first day because we were still partially in Mitzrayim. It's like a woman who was bleeding part of the day, so that day cannot count as a 7 clean days. You have to start from the next day.
So you answer that why you don't count all that?
Yes, that is the Zohar's answer. The Zohar's answer why we do not count Omer on the first day of Pesach. Because the Omer represents the 7 clean days of preparation. In fact, the Torah Tamima even suggests, although historically this can't be the reason, I mean it's obviously not the reason, that is why the minhag of the Omer is not to get married during the days of the Omer. Because since the Omer represents days of separation, so consequently there's marital separation as well. But again, that doesn't really fit because husbands and wives are not practicing abstinence. But he's saying we don't get married to show that the marriage is not ready to be consummated. But let me give you yet another answer. This is from the, I think, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's more of a mystical or philosophical answer. But he points out like this. Let's take the words, Mimacharas HaShabbas, literally. The day after Shabbos, although we know it means the day after Pesach. But if you look at the words literally, the day after Shabbos is what is often referred to in English literature as the eighth day. Right? There's even a novel, Thornton Wilder wrote the eighth day. There's something significant about the eighth day. The eighth day is the start of a new beginning, right? 1 to 7 is the completion of a cycle. The eighth day is a new beginning. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe says that Shabbos, as we said before in the name of the Meshech Chachma, is a very passive experience. We simply sit back and open our hearts to receive the holiness of God. Right? Shabbos, we refrain. What is the essence of Shabbos? We refrain from creativity. We refrain from malacha. We hold ourselves back to acknowledge that God is the source. So Shabbos is opening ourselves up to God's gift. Mimacharas HaShabbos is taking Shabbos into Sunday. Right? You take the ideas of Shabbos and you begin, as it were, to bring them into everyday life. So Lubavitcher Rebbe says since, if it's the idea, since what Svira and Shavuos is taking God's gifts and integrating them into everyday existence, it makes a lot of linguistic sense that we refer to the process of the Omer as the day after Shabbos. See, what the Rebbe is doing is, he's actually allowing a literal interpretation to come into this by saying that the spiritual avoda of Svira is like the avoda of a Sunday morning. In America we would say Monday morning, but Sunday morning. And that is to say, after you've experienced the spirituality of the Shabbos, you have to take that spirituality and bring it into the week. And therefore, the avoda of Svira has a shaychus, has a connection to the eighth day, Macharas HaShabbos. And he brings a remez from the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya was the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. This is the meaning of the first verse in Shir HaShirim, where the Shir HaShirim is about a woman and a man, but allegorically it's understood to be the passionate love between God and the Jewish people, where the woman cries out to her lover, Mashcheini acharecha, pull me to you. Meaning, I'm helpless, I can't move, pull me along. And the next words are, Narutza, and we will run together. Meaning, the process starts off where God takes us, Mashcheini acharecha, and then there's Narutza. Okay, Pesach is Mashcheini acharecha, Narutza is Shavuos. Again, all ties into the Meshech Chachma. It's a good example of a Hasidic thought. One of the great Misnagdim come to the same place, and that is Mimacharas Hashanas. Shabbos is passive at some level. Mimacharas is the ability to bring it into the week. Mashcheini acharecha, Narutza. And this is the great avoda of Shavuos, to make God's gifts our own gifts, to come to God with a sense, not of equality of course, but a sense of reciprocity, of giving back for all of the chasadim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has shown us in Ruchnias and in Gashmias. I'm sorry, what time do you have? Do you have time for another? Oh, it's already 2 after. Okay, alright. Okay, we'll stop here and we'll continue tomorrow. There's just a few more thoughts about the Omer and then we'll... Okay. Yeah, sure. We're going to be on my own.